You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges.
Over the last 6 to 7 weeks, more than 30 million Americans have applied for unemployment benefits. A significant portion of the people who are unemployed in this country are aged 55 and older. This is a vulnerable population that oftentimes are the first to lose their jobs and the last to be rehired. Here to talk with me about this today is Gary Officer, the president and CEO of Center for Workforce Inclusion. Gary, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Ramona, and good afternoon to you.
I'd love to start with this idea that there are so many, such a big proportion of the people who are unemployed are 55 and older. Why is that?
We have to look at this through the prism of two significant factors in American life. One, I think the manifestations and the legacy of 2008, where so many Americans who were about to retire pretty much lost everything as a result of a last great recession, a recession that wiped off about $6 trillion of wealth from individuals, a recession that forced many of these individuals to remain in the workforce longer than they wanted to. So now we have in that group low-income folks, folks who never really had careers, they had jobs, families who are raising their grandchildren, who have had to remain in the workforce as a matter of survival. Survival is also informed by lack of healthcare access. Now you're working to get access to health insurance. That's one segment that I think has been affected again by the coronavirus. The second group I think we have to consider are the many Americans who have no savings. Usually, if you experience a major catastrophe, you can rely on your savings to help you get through the day. Well, the reality is, I think 60% of Americans can barely find $400 in their account were they to experience a catastrophe. And you put the two forces together now, lack of savings, lack of healthcare, and the legacy of the last recession. And now you have that population, that group that is severely affected by this COVID pandemic.
When we talk about the people who've lost their jobs, I think you said it pretty well, is that these are people who had jobs, not careers.
Yes.
So they're some of them are living paycheck to paycheck, and they're doing low-skill jobs, low-wages jobs. How do we deal with this now? How do we get these people back to work or help them out right now?
I think the real question for us is going to be, how do we as a nation and how do we as a society value and validate the workforce aspirations of our more disadvantaged neighbors? When we as a country, compared to our Asian competitors, are investing less than a third of GDP in workforce training, that's an issue. When we as a nation rank in the bottom 15th percentile of OECD competitors for workforce spending, that's a problem. When we find and fund a $2 trillion stimulus package, and yet only $111 million of which is geared towards workforce development, that's a problem. So we have to invest in the subject matter. We have to have a sense of responsibility, a sense of ownership for the needs of populations and communities who have that sacred American value that drives everybody, which is, I want a job so I can support my family. Until we can get those things right, we will never solve this problem. We often celebrate military veterans, as we should, but we have never really celebrated ordinary workers, as we should. When I saw Prince Harry and the Queen, everybody else clap those healthcare workers in Britain. They were clapping for a national health service, right? And yet I'm challenged with why, as a nation, we have never really given props to our frontline workers. Those bus drivers who are out there in the cold in Chicago. Those cashiers working in underserved communities being threatened by angry customers. people doing a yeoman's job on a day-to-day basis to support their families. We never talk about them. And they are our hidden heroes. As much as we value our military heroes, we should extend our appreciation to those ordinary people performing frontline work.
Do you think this is an issue of how we look at our older adult population? How do we look at them? Where is the respect?
One of the things that I picked up in this whole pandemic is something that the governor of New York has repeated on several occasions. We have to be able to be somewhat introspective. We have to be somewhat self-critical in how we have looked and examined our past practices and opinions of people to make sure this experience we're going through never repeats itself. Older Americans are the most vulnerable segment of our community. And in the workforce, they too are the most vulnerable. Many of these folks occupy the lowest positions. That they are the folks who are working in retail, they're the cooks, they're the drivers. We talk about hospitals and doctors and nurses. We don't talk about the LPNs. We don't talk about the environmental specialists who clear the rooms, right? And when we begin to take a more expansive view of work and the value of work and what it means to that person and that community, then we can begin to understand and invest in a population that typically is on the higher end of a spectrum. Typically, these folks are 55 and over, but not 85. But our society values youth. Our society values vigor. And our society does not feel, I think, enough that those qualities are represented in our older neighbors. That's a problem.
I agree with you totally. I think that is a problem because there's this idea that older adults are afraid of technology or they're afraid of change, where there are plenty of people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and older even, who are adapting and have adapted. We've had cell phones forever. We've had conference calls forever, and people know how to do those. So it's quite frustrating to watch.
That's a good point. My average employee here is about 59 years old, so I have an older workforce. Yet, we're now a fully telecommuting organization. They all have laptops. We all do Zoom calls. And these aren't young people. But what separates my employees from people who are maybe perhaps lower income is that my employees remained in the workforce and grew with technology. And when you exit the workforce, you fall a few generations behind every 6 months on the platforms you need to be somewhat proficient at and in using to remain connected and remain valuable to an employer.
Opportunity and access.
Absolutely.
So after the last Great Recession, older job seekers had about 40% chance of finding a job within 18 months.
Yes.
Do you think there's anything we could be doing right now to change those numbers?
First of all, I think nobody has the answer to these fundamental questions, by the way. And these questions, I think, is informed by a sense of urgency that we have to find ways to take people back into the workforce. Now, 10 years ago, and in the early parts of this decade, if you lost your job in 2008, you would transition to being an Uber driver in 2007, 2008, up to the current day. I have a friend who's an Uber driver in Chicago. He hasn't worked in 7 weeks. He's 57 years old. The city is empty. He says, Gary, I'm burning gas. So the gig economy was the place many of our older and motivated folks transitioned into to earn supplemental income, and in some cases, to replace lost income. That's no longer, for the time being, an easy option. Some folks turn to Airbnb. I went on a site yesterday to look up Airbnb usage, and I'm looking at lots of vacancies and coronavirus specials, right? So what we had as gig economy or supplemental income segments of our economy that people could default to, that temporarily doesn't exist. So the answer for me has to come and I hate to use this term, has to come with increased federal government participation in the economy. Help people get by until the economy turns around. Make significant investment in workforce development so that we can prepare people for jobs that will emerge when this pandemic crisis and the recession that we are currently in has begun to recede. I mean, that's the only path I can see as of this day.
Until just the other day, the Center for Workforce Inclusion was known as Senior Service America. You've changed your name, but you haven't changed your mission. You're still about helping make the workforce ready for jobs now and in the future. Tell me a little bit about why you changed the name and if there is any subtle differences in the mission.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. And I'll be absolutely candid. I have found great resistance in the marketplace among non-federal, non-government stakeholders, funders, and donors with the use of the word senior. And that really is a statement about our culture. It's a statement about how we view our older populations. And it affected our ability to participate in important conversations, important policy conversations, economic discussions around workforce development. So we changed the name in part to provide an easier pathway into those conversations, to influence influencers on the needs of Americans, older Americans, marginalized Americans, ex-offenders, veterans, folks living in rural communities lacking broadband. We have a much better platform to engage in those conversations with the name, the Center for Workforce Inclusion. Two, we've also rebranded our subsidiary organization, which will now be called CWI Labs. We will retain a resident fellow in residence, and we'll be putting out original content and original blogs in the space of workforce and economic inclusion issues, so that we can position ourselves as the authority in this space going forward. And that's really why we did that.
What kind of partners are you looking for? What kind of programs are you advocating for?
We have conducted a pretty detailed assessment and took great stock at who we were serving and where our folks were. And we found some interesting observations. We found that about 15% of folks we were serving were veterans. Underserved, excluded veterans. About 75% of folks that we were serving were a single female head of households, older, raising their grandchildren. We found that we had a deep concentration of programming and partners across the South, a region that has almost minimal broadband coverage, which in itself creates obstacles to workforce access. We were in certain cities, but the places we were in were extremely underserved communities. So now we have a sense of who we are and where we're serving. How can we build custom programming in each of those categories to initiate donor, stakeholder, and funder interest? And that's really sort of the basis in part as to who we're serving and why the name change fits into that direction.
You brought up something when we were talking previously about what informs our policy around aging and poverty in this country. I found that really interesting. I'd love you to share that with our listeners.
Thank you. I've been thinking hard about the lessons that we can all learn from this once-in-a-generation pandemic. Now is a time for all of us to think critically about ourselves, about our past practices. And now is the time for us to ask ourselves, what lessons can we learn from others that may inform how we may create a fairer, a more inclusive, and a more morally adjusted society. And in this country, we often use the prism of the economy and economic policy to drive how we think society should act and who should benefit and how they may benefit. What I found in looking at other parts of the world, and it came up with Boris Johnson before he got ill, he made a speech where he said, and he repudiated Margaret Thatcher when he said, there is such thing as society. And what that means is that leadership has a greater sense of a societal obligation for which it is responsible to. And that obligation then informs economic policy. So if we're saying as a society, we want to be more inclusive, more tolerant, provide greater access and opportunity for every segment of our community, then economic policy should be prioritized around those outcomes. So to use the example of the stimulus package, we use a stimulus package to support the business community through different instruments with the Small Business Administration, with unemployment extensions, but we haven't thought about using a stimulus package to provide ordinary Americans, hardworking Americans, Americans who are now fearful of their future. We have not yet provided them the resources to retrain, to retool, and to re-enter the workforce that may emerge when this crisis has come to an end. We've got to focus as much of a debate on how we view society, how we can make it more fairer, and use the mechanism of the economy to inform positive society outcomes.
That was Gary Officer, the president and CEO of Center for Workforce Inclusion. My producer is Larry Buell. Our executive producers are Melissa Panzer and Joan Lynch. I'm Ramona Schundelheim, editor-in-chief of Working Nation. Thank you for listening. Join us next time.